You're listening to West Southwest on WMUK. I'm Arlene McMichael. Coming up, WMUK's Gordon Evans speaks with mental health treatment advocate Kevin Hines. He is the featured speaker for this year's Respecting Differences program in Kalamazoo. But first, we explore why the United States has the highest rate of incarceration of any country in the world. That's according to Tim Reddy, director of Western Michigan University's Lewis Walker Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnic Relations. And we'll also find out why there is a disproportionate number of people of color behind bars in America. The Race Institute has been tackling these questions in recent weeks as part of its four-part Unequal Justice series of forums. The next lecture is Tuesday night. It addresses challenges facing ex-offenders. The presenter is Marcus Collins, head of Restore Ministries, a Kalamazoo program that helps those with criminal records resettle into society. In advance of Tuesday's forum, I met last week with Collins and Race Institute Director Tim Reddy to learn more about the ever-growing prisoner population, which is leading to a ballooning ex-offender community. Reddy talks first.
The issue of ex-offenders is really concentrated in a pretty small segment of the population. First of all, upwards of more than 60% of people who are incarcerated in the United States have not completed high school. The incarcerated population, and hence the ex-offender population, as people get out, are very disproportionately African-American. In state and federal prisons, African-American and Latinos outnumber whites, despite the fact that there are far more whites than there are Latinos and African-Americans in the population. The odds of going to prison for an African-American is six times greater than it is for a white person. Hence, the challenges facing ex-offenders are really concentrated in that community.
It might surprise some people why that is the case, that more individuals of color are incarcerated. Can you give us some historical context for that?
The historical context really is that while there has always been some disparity in American history racially in incarceration rates, the incarceration rate for everybody, but particularly African Americans, rose precipitously starting in the early 1970s. That started with the war on drugs and the war on crime and kind of a change of attitude that was reflected in sentencing guidelines, laws, and also the assignment of prison to offenses related to drugs. And, you know, the underlying causes, one is, you know, having to do with the disparities in poverty and essentially racial injustices that totally differentiate opportunities by race and class that exists in this community as it does around the United States. In this community of Kalamazoo, 63% of African-American kids are living in poverty. And that greatly affects their chances of success in school, unfortunately. This is well documented nationally as well as locally.
I'd like to dig a little deeper on the war on drugs. I know it led to an overall increase in arrests, but why particularly African Americans? I've heard that it's not necessarily that people of color are doing any more crimes, but perhaps maybe the policing might be focusing more on them.
Well, it's in some way it's both, and there's a lot of research, and we've done the research. An excellent source on this is a report that recently came out from the National Research Council of the National Academy of Sciences, very impartial. Study that found that for a long time, yes, there was an increase in crime, and yes, African Americans were somewhat more likely by, you know, the best studies to be involved in crime. But at the same time, there's targeting that has happened by policing. And we know this in our own community based on the study that the Kalamazoo Department of Public Safety has done on traffic stops and what happens after traffic stops, that there is a certain amount of racial targeting that goes on that is really not warranted by anything having to do with law enforcement. And so this happens, and this occurs at every stage of the criminal justice system. If I could, I pulled a quote from this study, and I'd sort of like to read it because I think it says it all. It's from that National Research Council report that came out in 2014. Racial disparities in imprisonment reached extreme and unprecedented levels in the 1980s and 1990s and have remained at deeply troubling levels. They are partly caused and significantly exacerbated by recent sentencing laws aimed at achieving greater severity, certainty, and crime prevention, and by law enforcement strategies associated with the war on drugs. They are also they also result from small but systemic racial differences in case processing, from arrest through parole release, that have substantial cumulative effect. And they are influenced by conscious and unconscious bias and stereotyping that remains pervasive in America despite the near disappearance of widespread beliefs about racial superiority and inferiority. So this report is saying that bias is absolutely part of what is happening and that it occurs in the criminal justice system from policing on through the courts and through probation and parole decisions. At the same time, the underlying issues of poverty and disadvantage and lack of opportunity do lead to some differences in crime. So they're both factors.
But this war on drugs has been targeting even individuals with small amounts of drugs, and they find themselves incarcerated and with a record.
Yes, all of the studies that I'm aware of show that the usage and even the sale of drugs, there's really very little evidence that there is a racial disparity in those, you know, in who's selling drugs or using drugs between whites and blacks. But it is definitely true that enforcement has concentrated on African Americans. There was a great article actually in the New York Times that documented the sale and distribution of heroin in suburban contexts and how essentially it is totally under the radar, hardly ever gets caught. Yet we have a growing, you know, really epidemic of addiction to opiates in suburban settings. And this is not really showing up in the criminal justice statistics.
What are some of the solutions to this high rate of incarceration of African Americans and others of color?
There are some things specifically in the criminal justice system getting at bias. We need to become aware of it and to take systemic action to address it. It's from 2000 to the present in 2015, for the last 15 years, there has been a growing disparity or disassociation between arrests and incarceration rates. So the racial disparities from 2000 onward have gotten way worse than they were before. That has to do with sentencing and what we're doing. That has to change, and what we consider normal in the criminal justice system has to change. At the area of primary prevention, you know, the underlying issues having to do with, getting in trouble with the law, et cetera, and violating the law, are really related to other problems associated with the concentrated disadvantage that you see in high poverty neighborhoods, which tend to be predominantly minority neighborhoods. There are the same issues behind the disproportionate infant mortality that we see among African Americans. The same issues behind education disparities. And essentially, this gets to we need to, as a society, to ask ourselves, are we going to tolerate the level of inequality, you know, that we do tolerate, which is really greater than any other developed country in the world? And, you know, we can ask ourselves the question, is it the right thing to do ethically? And we might come down in different places on that question. But beyond that, it's also an issue of enlightened self-interest. Central core cities such as Kalamazoo and other cities, particularly in the Midwest, that have large suburban areas around them, have, you know, concentrated populations of low-income people. This affects the tax base. This affects all kinds of problems that tend to be concentrated. And we need to really ask ourselves the question, does this make sense? Can't we do better?
And when we talk about solutions, somewhere in your materials, I saw something about the minimum mandatory sentences. Does that need to be changed in your view?
You know, absolutely. The whole sentencing pattern of mandatory minimums, three strikes laws, you know, everything I read says that we are, as a nation compared to other nations in our state in particular, you know, way, way out of line with what other countries are doing. There is no reason to put people away for such long long sentences, and for that matter, there are many offenses that really should not require incarceration at all.
Now, on the back end of all this high rate of people of color being incarcerated is eventually they do come out of prison, and getting acclimated into society can be tough. I'd like to turn our attention now to Marcus Collins. He's the director of Restore Ministries that's based on the campus of Bethany Reformed Church in Kalamazoo. It's a nonprofit. Mr. Collins, tell us a little bit about what your organization does.
Yes, Restore Ministries, we really help work with individuals who are leaving prison or jail, returning back to Kalamazoo, with providing those transition skills. Such things would be housing, education, health and well-being, and life skills.
What have you found are the biggest needs facing the ex-offender?
I think that one of the biggest needs is just an opportunity for employment. A lot of these individuals returning back into prison, they feel as they're set up for failure. They're unable to get employment due to their criminal records, unable to provide efficient housing, adequate housing, and just unable to get the normal resources that they need to be successful in the community due to their stint in jail or prison.
Tell me a little bit about what your program does.
We like to work with individuals prior to release. So what can we do them? What can we do for them to be prepared? So we'd like to look into what are the basic needs: is housing, clothing, and food.
How do you find out about them prior to their release?
We have an application process. Our program's been around for about 15 to 20 years, so it's just kind of word of mouth. We serve individuals throughout the state, but anyone returning back to Kalamazoo.
And how soon before their release do you begin to work with them?
I like to start 6 months to 60 days prior to release.
When you look at these applications, what allows a person to be accepted into your program?
We try to accept everyone to the program because we feel that everyone who's returning back into the society needs some assistance. One of our primary focus that we like to focus on are the ones that are maxed out. That's the clients that are either who completed their full length of their prison term. And so once they return back to the community, they have no probation or parole and they have no assistance. So we like to call it the ones where they just open the door and fly into the wind.
Let's pause right there. They open the door. What does a ex-offender get when they walk out the door?
An ex-offender, once they walk out the door, will get a $50 transition card to maybe help with a bus fare to the location they need to get to. And that's about it.
So they literally open the door and that's it.
That's it.
What does that look like for most individuals who leave prison? If they've been in prison, do family members tend to abandon them? What's their first stop like?
A lot of them, they're devastated. They feel a lot of hopelessness. They haven't spoken to their family members in a long time. Some of them have passed away. A lot of them have, they spent so much time in prison that they no longer have those relationships built or they haven't been visited. So they're kind of just all alone on their own and they're scared.
I'm trying to imagine that if someone just opened the door and I was incarcerated for a period of time, where do they go? Do they find out where the nearest homeless shelter is? Where is it that they go? Do they sleep on the street? What happens?
I've seen it all. Sleeping on the streets, nowhere to go. And that's why some of the recidivism rates are so high, because once they get out, they want to recommit another crime and go back into prison, because at least they'll be fed there, they'll have shelter there, and have a place to reside their heads.
And how long do you stay in contact with them?
Our transition program is designed to work with an individual from 12 to 18 months. We believe within the 12 to 18 months, we can be able to have them find affordable housing, employment, or education to get themselves back onto their feet. But we continue to have an aftercare program to make sure that they still have the services or the context that they need to be successful. Because the transition time is hard. It might be extended past that time. A lot of guys are coming back into the community with just a box in their hand and their belongings from there. They're unaware of what's going on in the community. A lot of things have changed since they've been back into the community. They've been gone for a long length of time. So even just using a basic cell phone, a lot of them remember when pay phones were available. So we know we don't even see pay phones anymore. So we have a transitional house where they can be able to reside and stay. And then we, help provide food.
Playing devil's advocate here, why should society care?
I think society should care because even despite that they served their time, they did their time, but they're coming back to our society. So they're still members of our society. So I believe that they still need those same services to prevent this ongoing cycle that's just manifesting and continuing to happen again. if we don't provide the services that these individuals need coming back into town, then we're going to have these same alarming rates of recidivism, crime, theft. I think if we're able to be proactive and provide some of the necessary skills that anyone needs coming back into town, then we'll be able to have a more safer environment for everyone.
For a longer version of my interview, go to our webpage at WMUK.org. You'll hear Marcus Collins, himself an ex-offender as a juvenile, share his difficult journey to finding employment after more than 230 job interviews. For WMUK's West Southwest, I'm Arlene McMichael.